That's basically what we're talking about here on part of this is we not standing alone. That's part of what it is. We have so many people that are affected by substance abuse, alcohol, all the different things. And so I think it's important as part of what we have in Jack, who's coming from an ordained minister, a believer, as well as having dealt with it for the last 16, 18 years. And so trying to help us because as part of it started on a Wednesday night, we've been, some of the different people are meeting with family and who are having difficulties with it, but basically how to better handle it. And so I did a counseling deal with a person before, and we were always trying to sway conversations. So I just use that as those letters, but sways, seek first to understand and not to be understood. I think a lot of times we don't do that. And then looking for a win-win situation, most of the time it's a win-loss situation, and we need to do that. And then accounting, are we making deposits in people's lives? Usually making withdrawals. And then I just think also then the end of it is also then, is that are we thinking the end in mind? We're going to meet Christ, but also, is this going to help the situation? So that's why we're having Jack come and try to help us. This will be out for anybody that wants the presentation. It's going to be out, and then also he'll tell you how he can meet with you individually or whatever on a later date. We'll be glad to do that as a church or as an individual, trying to help. That's what we're here for, to help each other. So Jack, we'll let you come up and do the presentation on this part.
I think you have a pretty innovative church. I shared earlier how, we were in Arizona and came back to Oklahoma. Well, part of that transition was that I came back with a desire, for those of you that were not here, I shared how I was challenging our people that if we're going to reach people for Christ, we've got to get outside the church. And then there was that little voice, okay, big guy, will you get out? And that's how I got into this field. And part of that vision was to be able to get outside the church and work with people that typically are not going to show up in anyone's church. A lot of times they're just so overwhelmed with shame and guilt. They don't even like to come out during the day a lot of times. And so the vision was to get outside the church and to work with those who are struggling with some of the issues that we haven't found ourselves addressing. Too many times it's an us versus them kind of thing. If in many of our churches, if someone came in here and they're fresh out of prison with all the tattoos and the whole bit, we would do that number. Well, part of that journey of getting outside the church was also serving as a chaplain at Dick Connor Prison here in Oklahoma. So then the vision was to get outside the church and then attempt to bridge that gap, sort of let the church reach out to those that are outside the church. And how do you do that? And I probably haven't really... I'm not one to push myself, so I probably have not taken as much initiative as possible to be able to try to get that going. But I also know that a lot of churches wouldn't even think about doing what your church is doing this morning. Having a guy come in from the substance abuse field and spend Bible study time, you mean give up your Bible study time to do something like that, and then a focus in the worship time. So I appreciate Dan. I appreciate Michelle and the vision that she has. Our history goes back some, and I got to remembering that time we met was at lunch with this other lady and the organization and everything, and we got to share together in ministry for a shelter for women over in Pryor, and some exciting days there. So, what's up here? Okay. So, the title of this is Conquering the Fear of Hope. That sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Fear of hope. But it's amazing how many people that are struggling with issues like addiction, they're fearful to hope. You will, especially like in AA, folks that have been affiliated with AA, you'll often hear the thing, oh, I just do it one day at a time. I just do it one day at a time. Well, what are some of the goals that you have in life? Oh, I just do it one day at a time. And I think that one day at a time is they're having a difficult time envisioning a promising future. And they're probably got this little devil figure that taps them on the shoulder and head, says, hey, guy, don't get your head out there too much. Look how many times you've messed up. And so they actually develop this fear to really hope, to have hope. Asking questions is an art that Jesus practiced in a very unique way. I queried, and you can find at least 100 questions that Jesus asked in his life and ministry. So while leaving Jericho, Jesus and the disciples, they came up on these two blind men. And these men were crying out, Master, Master, have mercy on us. Master, have mercy on us. And Jesus asked them a very profound question. And this passage raises profound questions for each of us. How well do we know what we really need? And in working with people struggling with addiction and mental health issues, you know, what you're supposed to do is develop a treatment plan. And so part of that treatment plan is they identify problems that they work on. And then they are to set goals. And it's amazing how many times they really struggle to be able to set a goal. It would be sort of like, by the end of my time in this residential facility, one of my goals is. And they have a difficult time doing that because they have a difficult time understanding what they really, really need in life. So the question comes to us, are we fearful that God, family, and our Christian community will laugh at us, shun us, or give up on us if we open our eyes and stumble? I mean, I don't know what it would have been like. You're blind and all of a sudden you can see. Does that mean that they didn't need glasses and they were fully ready to go? Or did it mean that, you know, it's going to take them a little while to get adjusted to that and that they might stumble and would people laugh at them? But, you know, today that's an issue, isn't it? That it would be easy to not venture out because we're afraid that we might stumble a little bit. You know, we might have a relapse. And if we have a relapse, will people shun us? Every one of us have had relapses in here. How many of you have lived a perfect life since you became a Christian? We've all relapsed back into sin, haven't we? Sometimes it's more noticeable with other people. But Jesus asks some questions. Are you tired? Are you worn out? To this crowd, he said, are you burned out on religion? Come to me. He says, get away with me and you'll recover your life. Isn't that intriguing? I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. I had a guy in a group one night, and we were talking about spirituality. And in AANA, the phrase higher power is used. And this individual said, my higher power is my pickup truck. Well, I appreciated the reach for that sense of transcendence. But at the same time, I said, you know, I was a locomotive engineer on the railroad, and we had new vehicles every year, had all that stuff, you know. And I told him, I said, you know, I don't think that any of those vehicles that I had are still on the road today. I said, most of them are either in the junkyard or they've already been melted down. And if I'm going to select a higher power, I want one that has more power than an old rusted out truck sitting in a junkyard somewhere. And so Jesus invites us to come along with him. I mean, what would it be like for all of those struggling with some form of addiction, whether it be a substance or a process addiction, to hear the words of Jesus? He says, don't fret or worry. Instead of worrying, pray. Let petitions and praises shape your worries into prayers, letting God know your concerns. Before you know it, a sense of God's wholeness, everything coming together for good, will come and settle you down. It's wonderful what happens when Christ displaces worry at the center of your life. You know, there's a lot of people outside the church, and they at best would say, well, you know, that may work for some people like Brother Dan, but that wouldn't work for me. And they miss that opportunity to hear and to respond to Jesus when he says, like he does in Matthew 20, 32, what do you want me to do for you? I mean, think about it. If you have family members, close friends that are struggling with addiction, and Jesus comes and sits down as your counselor, and he asks you, what do you want me to do for you? Now think about that. I could have phrased it this way. What do you want me to do for them, for you? Now, it's a personal question. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. He's sensitive to all those needs out there. Not a one of them that he's not aware of. But when you sit down with him, his question is, what do you want me to do for you? And we all come to the table with needs. How well do we understand those needs? Your story is your story. Your losses are your losses. But we all have collective losses. Collective grief happens when a community or society or a village or a nation all experience some extreme change or loss. Addiction has remade America in so many ways, it's unreal. For those that don't have to deal with it on a day-to-day basis, you don't think about it until something happens, you know. And then the news media moves on to other stories and it's like it's gone. But we all have collective losses. I gave the illustration earlier of the young woman that hit a police car and had to be dragged out of the police car, and her son was in. That's part of our story. That's happening in our communities. Person who has a head-on collision and is killed because someone's driving under the influence of alcohol or some other drug. That's our collective story, isn't it? But we all have our stories. I've often said I'd love to be able to plug my brain up to a computer and download all the memories that I have. It would be incredible. But some of those are personal. I preached a series of sermons when I was at First Baptist You follow. And it started, the goal of that series was the introduction because we were going to start a support group in our church, and we didn't pick one issue like addiction or whatever. It was like for anybody struggling, come. And so I preached this series, Keeping the Puzzle Intact. And I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands because you don't know me very well. I don't know how comfortable you would be raising your hand, so I don't want anyone to just embarrass yourself by raising your hand. Okay, but I started out with a series of questions. How many of you or someone in your family has been impacted by addiction? How many of you or someone in your family, and I went through a litany of questions, I got down to the last question, and I said, I don't want any of you to raise your hand on this question. How many of you or someone in your family has been impacted by sexual assault? Over 90% of the people in those two different worship services we had raised their hand to at least one of those questions, and many of them to several questions. And on the last questions, I could read people's faces. I could number off the ones that had, whose lives had been impacted by sexual assault. My dad was an alcoholic, even a practicing alcoholic as a bivocational minister. Who would never acknowledge it. Looking back, I realized that by the time I was in the ninth grade, I was addicted to alcohol. I used to, as a locomotive engineer, I used to run a train 12, 14 hours a day after consuming close to a fifth of blackjack whiskey. And I know how, even though I had stopped shortly after the birth of our daughter and before our son, I can now look back and see the residual effects of that on my family. It has an impact. I know what it's like to work with a man whose son has struggled with schizophrenia and substance abuse for years, and he looks 20 years older than he actually is. He had to go back to work after retirement. I have a friend who has a son that became so threatening that she had to get a protection order and get him outside the home and went a number of years without speaking to him. Because with his schizophrenia and substance abuse issues, he couldn't live a normal life. And the heaviness of her heart. My wife has a cousin whose four children and her husband has struggled with addiction. Her husband was a deacon at the First Baptist Church of Florine, Louisiana. That's where we're from, Louisiana. Now he struggles with a failing liver. One son came out of a convenience store under the influence, headed down the wrong side of the road, had a crash, paralyzed a young man, 18-year-old man, and then later he died. On and on and on the stories could go. But your story is your story. Michelle shared this. I had posted it on Facebook. Policymakers and communities are ready to save our youth from the devastation of addiction, an ideal vision. Fort Gibson School District this past week, the focus was on prevention, drug prevention. What we too often call prevention, though, is actually early intervention. The average age for young people to have started experiencing drug abuse is 12 and a half. My grandson's 13. What we really need is an approach that focuses on prevention from an individual, family, and societal addiction perspective. Because we've all been impacted in some ways by addiction. Something that is more complex than using. It's deeper than just a person using a drug. It has fingers that affect so many people, it's unreal. So this assumes that everyone has been affected by addiction, directly, indirectly, through peers and family, or the multi-generational perspective that I mentioned earlier. So this calls for a systemic change that will enable us to look at addiction and recovery from a holistic viewpoint. And that's why my heart is filled with joy for you having the willingness to say, this is important enough that we dedicate some time to focus on this. And that's so key. So when the brain hurts, it puts that pain somewhere. And by hurt, that can be an emotional hurt. You know, my grandson, who is 13, he and his dad and his mother went through a horrible divorce when he was 6. They were living in Florida. And so out of that devastation, our son came back to Oklahoma to try to figure out how to put his life together. And wondering, how can I get back down and see my son and spend time with my son? And just out of the clear blue, Dylan's mother called my son and said, you can come get Dylan. That just had a different feel to it. And she didn't say for the rest of the summer or for a week or two, you know. And I put a very legal sounding document together that the heading was out-of-state travel and provisional housing. And she signed it, and she gave my son a manila folder with Dylan's shot record, birth certificate, and Social Security card. Do you think he has struggled with some emotional stuff through that? And I'm very sensitive, even though we had him in counseling for about a year, I'm very sensitive, and I talk with him from time to time about how that can become an issue. So it can come out in stress, anger, anxiety, worry, depression, family conflict, broken relationships, loss of trust, financial problems. Premature mortality is associated with chronic mental health issues, a 10 to 25-year decrease in life expectancy. Now, if you've got a friend or a close friend or you've got a family member that's struggling with addiction, can you have some stress, anger, anxiety, worry, depression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It can cost you 10 to 25 years of your life. When the brain hurts, it puts that pain somewhere. Fibromyalgia, It's kind of like a phantom issue. You know, the elbow really hurts, but medically there's no known reason for that elbow to hurt. And I believe, and our psychiatrists agree, that when that brain hurts, it puts the pain somewhere. And that has to be treated as if it's a real issue. But if that brain puts that pain right here, you've just increased the likelihood of having a stroke or a heart attack if it's not addressed. What happens is that when a person is under stress, there's a high release of this hormone called cortisol, and you need it. You know, if you're sitting there about ready to go to sleep, and all of a sudden there's a big old dog that burst into this room, you need a high trigger of cortisol to figure out how you're going to respond. Because you might be, otherwise you might be sitting there and everybody else has already cleared out the room. So it's part of our survival. But I don't know if you've ever lived under one of those intense, stressful times. Like when I came up on a wreck where all my friends were involved, and there was a friend that had sideswiped a car, rolling his best friend between those two vehicles who had been riding on a motorcycle. And there were people screaming and yelling and bones sticking out of people's lives, and me walking up to that body, and you couldn't make sense of the body. It was all twisted in every angle imaginable. Can you imagine the cortisone that was going? But could I have lived that way always? But sadly, sometimes people struggling with family or friends who are addicted, they're living that way, and they're not taking care of themselves. My computer's being a little slow. So this is a kind of what I call a full cup here. So a person starts out, and this can be the person that's struggling with addiction, or it can be that family member But it starts out with some deep hurt that is there. And then it can turn into anger, resentment, bitterness. And then it can turn into true guilt, maybe even retaliation. And then there's all these insecurities and these fears that get in there. And then the stress and this anxiety. And when the cup is full and that stuff keeps coming in more and more and more and more and more and more, what does it look like when it spills over the top of the cup? That can be the escape into work, drugs, infidelity, pornography, etc. It can come out as depressed moods. It can come out as being impatient, quick temper. It can come out with physical side effects. It can interrupt sleep patterns and our appetite. It can be a loss of energy and concentration. A loss of emotions like joy, love, affection, romance. It comes out in some unhealthy ways if we're not careful. And so what we need is a safe place. At Rose Rock, we used a model called the sanctuary model, and it focused on four critical stages of recovery: safety, emotional, loss, and future. So by safety, it means that we need a physically safe place. Traditionally, I'm familiar with a church in St. Louis, and it was a predominantly black congregation, and they would be there 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was kind of like, why? And you know what their story was? Because of the neighborhoods that they lived in, the church was the safest place. And they just wanted to linger there. So safety means physical safety. It can be safety from physical harm. Psychological safety. The ability to keep oneself safe in the world, which includes self-discipline, self-esteem, self-control, self-awareness, and self-respect. And I've known a lot of family members who have struggled with someone in their family who lost all those kinds of things. And psychologically, they just ended up in an unsafe position. And sadly, many times, they'll kind of walk away from the church. There needs to be social safety, the ability to be safe with other people and relationships and in social settings. You think about the group that will be meeting here. I mean, y'all already met some. Hopefully that's a safe social place where people are accepted, they're welcomed. Moral safety, the ability to maintain a set of standards, beliefs, and operating principles that are consistent, that guide behavior, and they're grounded in respect for life. I was working in a residential facility for men, and we had a client that had gotten into so much legal trouble down through the years, it was just unreal. And he still was, at that time, he still was not sure that they would not send him to prison. And I did a group one morning, psychoeducation group, on values, the importance of values. And I'll never forget this guy coming up to me afterwards on break, and he said, "Jack," he said, "I was an Eagle Scout." And do you know what his recovery became about? Reconnecting with the safety of the values, the morals that he was taught, reconnecting to those that he was taught in becoming an Eagle Scout. So it's very important. John Newport wrote this neat little article called "Wellness Applications in Substance Abuse Prevention and Intervention." And he said, he draws our attention to the fact that middle school and high school is a dangerous period when many people, young people, will succumb to substance abuse and other dangerous kinds of practices. Boy, some of the parkour stuff just drive you crazy. During these critical years, young people most definitely need mentorship from concerned adults, he said. Historically, That function has been provided by concerned parents, schools, religious institutions, and other social institutions concerned with promoting these positive values. One of the presentations that I've done it a number of times at quite a few different conferences, and it's entitled The Integration of Spirituality and Psychotherapy. And it's amazing the interest that people have with that topic out there. I'm talking about professional people. And there's a section in there where historically I just show different moves that our society has made, where we started out back over here, where people turned to the church when there were real issues that they were facing. The Quakers was the first one to actually establish an asylum for mentally ill people. And then, you know, we kind of moved away from that with all the stuff that's going on, and that's a big issue right now in our society. But now I think is the time for the church to regain its place in the community. So the question is, will our churches adapt to the need to serve as mentors for young people? Fort Gibson has had a mentoring program. We haven't met last year and this year because of COVID, but I fear that it's going to be easy not to do it, and that's sad. My wife and I both serve as mentors with some of the students there, and I've been able to follow some of them all the way from the third grade, and now they're into high school, and it's very, very interesting. Titus has something to say about this. Every time I think of this, I think of my dad. And he thought that it was the place of the women to work with the young girls and train them and the men. Titus addresses that. He outlines first sort of the qualities of mentors. He says, guide older men into lives of temperance, dignity, and wisdom, into healthy faith, love, and endurance. So he kind of outlines, if you're going to be a mentor to young people, here are some of the qualities that you need. And then he challenges the older men to mentor the young men. But he also challenges the women to serve as mentors. He says, guide older women into lives of reverence, so they end up as neither gossips nor drunks, but models of goodness. You know, I didn't select that passage just because I was presenting this about addiction, but wow, there it is. But models of goodness. By looking at them, the younger women will know how to love their husbands and children, be virtuous and pure, keep a good house, be good wives. Now, in the first section, I looked at some of those things that would cause a child to experience some of those adverse childhood experiences. So that's what we have a lot in our society today. The children that are coming from broken homes, some of them, and I'm thinking of one family in particular right now, where the children have seen three different dads. And on and on and on and on we could go. And who is it that's going to serve as mentors for those? When I was a teenager, I was dating this girl and probably would not have been there if I hadn't been dating her. But she was a part of a church. And once a week, and I would always go, and it made an impact on my life. I would always go because there was a man that was always there. I don't remember my dad or mom ever hugging us. The only time I ever sat in my dad's lap was one time when we lived in Alabama and he wanted me to read the Bible to him. But Mr. Brown was always there. I can still smell that smell where he would put that cologne on after shaving. And I welcomed it, but it embarrassed me too. We could be downtown Leesville, And he could be coming down this side of the street, and I could be going this side. And when he would look over and say, "Jack," I knew what was going to happen. He was going to come flying across that street, and he was going to grab me, and he was going to hug me, and he was one of my mentors. Mm-hmm. Out of the brokenness of my family, he made a profound difference in my life. Will our churches adapt to the need to serve as mentors? We can spend a lot of time talking about the negative influencers that people will have to deal with. You know, the drugs are in our schools like you wouldn't believe. The person says he uses 2 or 3 times a day, daily, but he goes to school. What's he doing? Where's he doing it? When is he doing it? Who's around him? So we can really focus on the negative influencers and all those negative factors and then all of the negative behaviors that come out of that. But what about the positive side? Who are those influencers that bring positive factors to a person's life? Because you see, as we link ourselves with those positive influencers in our life, what will grow out of that is positive behavior, healthy behavior. And I think that's why it's so critical to listen to what Titus said. Vince Lombardi, "A man can be as great as he wants to be. If you believe in yourself and have the courage, the determination, the dedication, the competitive drive, and if you're willing to sacrifice the little things in life and pay the price for the things that are worthwhile, it can be done." And think about the number of people that he influenced with in his sports. Who were the influencers in your life? Who are the people that you perhaps have not even met face to face yet that you need to serve as a mentor for? It's a little model that I developed some years back, and I entitled it The Wonder of Praise. And so you have two sides. You have that theological side, and I'm not going to read them, but I'd encourage you, and as indicated, these slide presentations are yours, so just let us know. But the passages that we find in these psalms are incredible. It talks about an old song, Psalm 77 does, and what it was like back then, and the difficult time that the psalmist and the people were experiencing. And for us, on that existential side, it asks, where have I been? What's my story? What's back there? What have I attempted to leave behind me that I just can't shake loose? I will often hear people, when it comes to dealing with their trauma or whatever it may be, they'll say, "I don't think about it." And my response is, you may not think about it, but it thinks about you, and it puts that somewhere in your body. To illustrate how it can work, assessment, exploring trauma issues, were you ever physically abused? No. Were you ever emotionally abused? No. Were you ever sexually abused? No. But then I looked at the person and I said, "But your body just told me yes." And when I said sexually abused, there was just a little movement right there. And that became a key issue for that person to work on. Where have I been? So if I'm working with someone that's been addicted to alcohol or drugs, that's something I want to know. Tell me your story. What was it like growing up? What are things that happened back there? And sometimes if it becomes known by a family member, it can be very staggering. hidden, but it's there. And then Psalm 59 has to do with what I call a song being created. It's sort of like existentially, I'm not there yet, but where am I? And then the new song, where am I going? So the importance of spirituality is very key. You sense a higher sense of purpose, peace, hope, and meaning. And I believe that one of the keys to dealing with addiction is for a person to gain a purpose in their life. You heard me say how much I would drink. I went through my second surgery at age 28, and the surgeon came in the night before surgery and drew his finger around this way and said, "That's the type of incision I'm going to make. And we're pretty sure you have a malignant tumor in your pancreas." My life was falling apart in many respects. But one night, contemplating suicide, laying in the bottom of my boat, and to lead a bend down, that still, quiet voice came to me and said, "Jack, I can help you put your life back together again." And that was my awakening. When the doctor gave me permission to drive, I went into our kitchen and I filled up 2 trash cans full of bottles. I went into our bedroom and I pulled out a bale of marijuana. I put it in my truck. I drove out to the trash dump. I broke every bottle. I threw the marijuana into a fire that was burning and I did not inhale it. And I didn't just quit. I had a purpose. I had a newfound direction for my life. And I'm 71, will be 72 in February. And that purpose continues to drive me. And it's what I get excited about. And I believe that one of the keys to recovery is finding a purpose in life. I want to leave a little handout that I have for Michelle and Dan that just outlines some of the things that you can deal with in your support group. Now, I would say this too. It's important for you to get good information to be able to make some of the decisions that you may have to make. And so those are some topics where it will take someone helping you get the right kind of information. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to fly on here. You read that fast? So, in this addiction and mental health epidemic, what is Jesus seeking to do? So you have a bunch of religious leaders who were offended by Jesus' perspective, and he reached out to those the religious saw as dirty and deserving punishment. He broke down that us versus them attitude that the Jewish leaders had. He didn't love those who were struggling just superficially. He genuinely loved them. He loved them from a spiritual, mental, emotional, social, and physical perspective. Whatever their brokenness may be, he was there to listen to them. So, what is Jesus seeking to do? He's reaching out to the sick and brokenhearted. And Matthew says, "Who needs a doctor? The healthy or the sick?" Go figure out what this scripture means. I'm after mercy, not religion. I'm here to invite outsiders, not coddlers, inside. He's offering redemption and restoration and transformation. Jesus said, "I am the road, also the truth, also the life. No one gets to the Father apart from me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him. You've even seen him." Jesus is not acting pejoratively. In other words, he's not looking down. He's not condemning. He's not being harsh in a judgmental way, but he's holding before us the truth. Then Jesus turned to the Jews who had claimed to believe in him. If you stick with this, living out what I tell you, you are my disciples for sure. Then you will experience yourself the truth, and the truth will free you. So, you know, we have to set truth out there before people. They have to have something to base their decisions upon. So Jesus is calling the broken to maintain their dignity and to be able to choose the right path. Sometimes if we're not careful, we take people's dignity away because we try to dictate to them how we want them to live their life. But what we need to do is help people regain, maintain their sense of dignity, where they will realize that they are accountable for their own lives and they must make the right decisions if they're going to get into recovery. And he's offering intimacy with us. Live in me. Make your home in me just as I do in you. In the same way that a branch cannot bear grapes by itself, but only by being joined to the vine. You can't bear fruit unless you are joined with me. And you're very familiar with that passage in John 15 where he says, I'm the real vine and my Father is the farmer. So, drugs have this allure, a promise. And it's amazing, even when a person is having parts of their life that's falling apart, it's almost like sometimes they can't see that. Well, if I can get them, and there's always that allure. That allure sometimes is, at least when I'm using, I'm not experiencing. It's always a promise that, but then all of a sudden there's just not enough of it. You build up tolerance and all that. It moves people away from the possibility of a real life realized in God. We may see that sometimes. We may see that person that God intended them to be, but they struggle, but they gravitate toward this allure of anticipation. It's a life void of intended inspiration and future. But on the other side is the promise of life with purpose and meaning. So the question then is, which way are you facing? You've got this history. You've got all these adverse childhood experiences that you have encountered. You've lost your job. You've got all this stuff that's stacked up. But over here is the promise of a life with purpose and meaning. The key is, which way are you looking? And for family members, sometimes we just get stuck right here. It's kind of like we're just pulled back and forth. You know, sometimes we need to conquer the fear of hope because we can't turn loose the back. And it's almost a model that we don't have a model to present to people if we're stuck ourselves. But sometimes if we focus on being the person that God wants us to be, those that we love dearly, they may have a sober moment when they may think, I want that kind of life, and I've seen it happen. I'm not trying to make any of this simple and easy. So one of my lines is, if God could restore life to a dead body, why the fear that you cannot realize the life that he intends for you? Is there anything that he can't do in your life? Can he help you conquer addiction? Can he help you find peace as a family member? Can he give you the boldness as a family member to have an intervention and to be honest with that person, set some boundaries, develop a plan for your life? Jesus asked, what do you want me to do for you? Three words, deep from the heart of God. Come to me.